Well, it is a creepy and curious world out there. And today we head all the way down to the curious end of the spectrum. Maybe shed some light on your in-laws and shedding some of those extra winter kilos. Who doesn't need the help? Dr. Paul McDonald is with us this morning. Hey, Paul, how are you doing?
Morning, Cal. Good, good.
It's the way science can predict our body weight, which is a bit scary, but first, let's talk about the in-laws, first of all.
Yes, we ran out of time last time.
And yeah, that's
this
right.
is a very important topic. I thought we should get out there. But look, the research here was carried out looking at what impressed parents of children being courted by another individual. So a little bit strange. It's not really an angle that's had a lot of strict research involved in it. There's a lot of hearsay and a lot of suggested advice floating around there, shall we say. But look, it's not about in-law bashing, and I certainly wouldn't want to recommend that, as my mother-in-law may well be listening to this one, and they're wonderful people. But once that caveat's out of the way, it does sound like a really trivial question in terms of why one would need to impress your in-laws and so on in modern society. But the things we're talking about today are really get back to the important things that are shaped our evolutionary history, and also some of the things that impact on how well we might perform from a fitness perspective, even in the modern world. And in-laws often help with raising children and assisting through, say, financial hardship and things like that and so on. So really is quite important that everyone's happy in that extended family, and that leads to a happier life as well, beyond just the simple evolutionary fitness. So it is an interesting area, though, and one that I quite like in terms of the a lot of the research I do is into looking at social behavior and some of the why animals might work together and where there's conflicts. And human families is certainly one area where there's potential for conflicts, and one of the reasons is in partner choice. And I have two very young daughters, so it's all ahead of me with this, but I'm not particularly looking forward to it. But where the conflict is here is the offspring might be interested in physical characteristics, for example, in terms of their partner choice, whereas parents are more interested in things like social standing or family background and so on. So often those interests don't well align, and I'm sure there's many people listening that are fully aware of this. So what that tends to lead to is the parents can actually try and sabotage the relationship in some situations, or offspring try and manipulate their parents into accepting their partner and making sure they do so. So while, as I said, we've looked at partner choice in quite a bit of detail and also how the parents respond, there's not been much research looking at how the actual new partner that's in a relationship with the offspring interacts with the parents and how they try and smooth over the situation, if you like, and get in the in-laws' good books. So this study looked at Greek Cypriot children and looked at a range of strategies that they used. So the first thing they did was ask that new partner to list the whole gambit of things that they try to impress the in-laws or potential in-laws, a whole heap of different strategies. And then they actually took those to the in-laws and said, well, how would you respond to this particular strategy? So I'm a bit disappointed they didn't make them act it out and film it, but the survey was the safe choice. But nonetheless, then they had a look and see what worked successfully. And the things that often people talk about actually perform quite poorly. So one of the things you hear often is shower them in gifts and give them as many things as you can. They didn't particularly like that as the in-laws. They thought that was a bit shallow. The other strategy, which particularly didn't play out well, was stand up to them and basically argue that, no, you're the right choice and they're wrong. And unsurprisingly, the in-laws didn't like being told they were wrong, so that didn't work. Those strategies weren't the successful ones. But it sounds really, really simple, but from an evolutionary perspective, it actually makes quite a great deal of sense. And the best way to the in-law's heart is simply just to look after their child and be a good partner. So it sounds really simple, but who'd have thought? Just be a nice person and you actually might get accepted into the family. So that was really interesting. But they also had a look at how the potential mother-in-law and father-in-law interacted and looked at the contrast there. And Who do you think would be the easiest to win over, Kel?
Speaking hypothetically, yeah. My in-laws are way far away, so I don't know what I can get away with this week. I guess from both male and female points of view, or just either or.
This is for both combined, so they didn't split the sex of the new partner.
Okay, guys. I guess I would say for each gender, it would be the opposite sort of gender.
Yeah, that was my thinking actually, too, which is interesting. But I think interestingly enough, here it wasn't the mother-in-law that she was the mother was actually easier to win over and was more forgiving and more likely to accept a wider range of strategies and so forth. It was actually the father-in-law that was the harder one to win over here. And as I said, it's combining both sexes. So these are That's male and female quarters of the offspring, I guess. I don't know what the official suitors, I suppose, is the right term. But anyway, it sounds all very simple. But the best strategy for pleasing the in-laws is actually just to be nice to their child.
Just and to be nice.
Yeah, maybe you know, save the gifts up for the actual partner. Which
Dr. Paul McDonald with us on ABC New England Northwest, creepy but curious this morning, and really at the curious end of the spectrum today, talking about some of our human behaviours and our human activities. Okay, so we've dealt with the in-laws, and we're looking at a great Christmas now. what about as the weather's warming up? I guess we're seeing lots of ads. Endless ads on TV, really, to lose weight and shed those winter kilos. It's one of those terrible terms you hear. What's science doing around this issue?
Well, again, clearly we're exempt, Kelly, because we're on radio. We can say that this is, again, hypothetical. But look, food's very, very important. And we've talked about it a number of different times while we've been doing this. And finding enough food for an animal is really one of the key problems that they have in a daily period. And that drive to find food shapes a whole range of behaviours that you see, everything from, you know, migration to when an animal's active, when it actually potentially leaves its den or nest or burrow, or goes from standing still to actually actively searching for food. All those types of things are shaped by the need to obtain nutrients, and obviously they're needed to survive for daily maintenance, just to get through the next day, but also to store up some resources to get through a hard period such as winter, or reproduce. You know, all those types of things require energy. So finding enough food is one of those key problems that all animals have, and along with avoiding becoming the food of something else, and also then finding a mate when the time is right, they're probably the three most important things that shape an animal's behaviour. So we tend not to think about it too much from a human perspective, because, you know, barring, you know, apocalypse type movies where all those things are back on the table, in a modern society, those sorts of things aren't really at the forefront of how we think about our day-to-day life. But because they're so important, it's not really that surprising that they're still, those preferences are deeply seated in our the way our brains operate, and what we, the actual drives that we experience to consume food and so forth. So it explains why we really like things like chocolate, really high in nutrients. So when you're out foraging, for example, you go back right in deep evolutionary time. A really high nutrient, you know, nutrient-rich food type like that would be great. You only have to find one or two, and that's enough food for the animal for the whole day. It no longer has to do foraging, which is a risky thing to do, potentially. Sit back and relax, so to speak. So that preference for that really high-octane food, if you like, is a really important one that's been great from our evolutionary history. But it's a bit of an Achilles heel now, because those types of foodstuffs are readily available in modern society. One has to just simply get up, go to the cupboard or supermarket, and, you know, you can buy yourself, you know, 18 kilos of chocolate and away you go. So we've come a little bit of full circle now. So rather than in evolutionary times and much of the evolutionary history trying to get enough food to get by, now, modern society, we're really at the opposite end. We're actually spending a great amount of time, money and resources, as you mentioned with those ads and so on, actually trying to lose weight and reduce things. So it really is quite interesting from that angle. But science has also become involved in looking at that, because understanding how the brain works might well help us lose weight and increase fitness and so on, and avoid things that we've probably all heard of, the obesity epidemic and so on. A healthier population would be much better for people personally, but also less resources needed for medical facilities and so on. So it's really quite a big picture problem. So this study really caught my eye from Cornell up in New York State, in that it looked at the types of food that people have out and how that relates to their actual body weight and health, if you like. Again, they went with a survey and first asked people what types of things they'd eat and for their height and body mass. And humans are really difficult test subjects. And one of the great lines from the methods of the paper is that they had to actually throw out some data because the heights and weights of some of the respondents were not physically possible. So we're quite difficult to ask. We're very deeply ingrained in terms of, giving the right answer or not admitting that, perhaps you are a bit overweight and been eating the wrong things. We put down what you think the researchers want. So where this one got a bit interesting is they then went and did some home visits. And these were quite sneaky home visits, in terms of they just went and interviewed the person and, asked them a whole heap of general questions. But what their real motive for visiting the home was is to actually take photos of the kitchen and see what was actually out and the types of food that
That's
they had
really
out
sneaky.
On their counter. Yeah, well, scientists, you got to watch them. But what they then did is actually took the proper height and weight of people so they could calculate their body mass index, rather, or BMI. Now, if you're not familiar with that, that's essentially looking at how heavy you are for a given height. Mm. And there's some controversy around
it.
But
a bit controversial, isn't it? Yeah.
In general, if you're in the right ballpark of a BMI, you should be a healthier person, or at least in a healthier weight range. So really interesting insights then, and what they're trying to get at is the actual psychology of eating. What drives this overeating behavior or the wrong choice of food? So doing all that from that sneaky perspective of taking photos, which I thought was quite nice.
So they got in that way. All right, so then what were some of the foods that people had left out? Were they a bit dodgy? Are they caught out of it?
We'll start with the positives and go downhill from there. But no, interestingly, a fruit bowl was the main predictor of a healthy weight mass. So if you had a bowl of fruit out on your counter, regardless of whatever else was there, if that was sitting out on the kitchen bench or dining table in their home, people were far more likely to have a healthy body mass index. And that applied to both men and women. So a bowl of fruit, presumably easy access. If they're hungry, they're more likely to snack on fruit, for example. Mm. And that led to a healthier weight, or was correlated with a healthier weight more formally, I guess. But there were some negative results, that's what I might expect. And this is where it gets more interesting, because the sexes actually differed in what was their Achilles heel, I guess, if you like. For women, it was packaged foods. So they lumped things in that category. So bags of chips, pretzels, crackers, breakfast cereal, all the good stuff. Basically, if that was on the countertop, far more likely to have a higher BMI. And soft drink as well, even though it wasn't in the fridge and presumably not ready to drink. Some people that had soft drink, and it didn't matter whether it was a diet variety or the full sugar versions, people that had soft drink on their countertop were on average 11 kilos heavier than those that didn't. And the other big one was breakfast cereal. So that was perhaps the main predictor. And people that had breakfast cereal sitting out on their countertop, women, were on average 9 kilos heavier than the group that had them stored in the cupboard. So
that's interesting, isn't it?
All those
things are really interesting, aren't they?
Well, it's not... It's not magic here. I'm not suggesting if you put the the box of biscuits away and put an apple on your counter that suddenly you'll lose 9 kilos. But it gets towards how we operate, in terms of we eat so much with our eyes, and that drives cravings and so on to a certain extent. So it's why shows about cooking and someone work so well on TV at the moment.
Yeah, basically, I'm just watching the SBS ad. It hasn't started the programming yet, and I'm watching on loop their commercial. They've got a new food channel starting. So.
Yeah, getting hungry too.
Yeah,
while
just
you're doing
watch it. The power of suggestion, you know, it's terrible.
Yeah, and all this stuff while it's just out, you tend to snack on it. And for men in the study, it was lollies and also baked goods. So rather than the biscuits, the men in this study were hoeing into muffins and so on, things like that. So. Yeah, really interesting, I thought, in that just a simple photo of what's going on in your kitchen can predict the BMI and in general health of the person there. So perhaps if you are trying to shed a couple of kilos, then, yeah, you need to have a look and put some things away in the cupboard.
Put away. Just briefly, about 3 minutes to the news, Paul, but what do we need to know about breakfast cereal as well?
Well, this is another one where it shows how your brain can play a few tricks on you. And what they looked at is how much cereal people put in the bowl. And they adjusted the flake size. So we're talking about the actual, if you think of things like a corn flake or something like that, the actual flake component, not the nuts or fruit or whatever in it. And they crushed it up so that there's less air in the actual cereal and it's a denser product. So for each spoon of that cereal, if you like, you're getting more nutrients. They gave people a whole range of these different cereals from intact and crushed into ever smaller flake sizes and asked them to pour their normal amount into a bowl. And as you got more and more crushed and denser cereal, if you like, people put less in the bowl. So it looks good. We behave ourselves. We have the same amount and recognize that it's more crushed. But the brain actually gets it wrong, and we adjust a little bit, but not enough. So even though people are putting less in their bowl, the amount of nutrients in that bowl was still higher when the flake size was much smaller. So people thought and felt like they were doing the right thing and eating a smaller amount, but they're actually consuming more nutrients. So it goes to show that even though weighing out your food if you're trying to lose weight is quite tedious and no one likes doing it, but you know, when diet plans and so on say have half a cup of cereal for the breakfast, depending on the brand, the flake size and the actual content and so on, that half a cup's going to vary very widely in nutrients. So you can't just have half a cup of, you know, the old sugar coated cereals or whatever they might be and think you're doing the right thing. Or you know, so perhaps again, the take home message perhaps is to buy a muesli with very large flakes and you'll feel like you're eating a lot more than what you actually are.
Yeah. Try and trick your brain back. You know, your brain's trying to trick you.
That's right. You've got to fight back, Kel.
Fight back indeed. Good on you, Paul. It's fascinating. I'm going to go home and look at my kitchen now and see what's on the shelf. I'm trying to think back there. A couple of bananas that are well past their use-by date. Yeah, there's definitely chocolate there.
Yeah. Red flag, Kel.
Red flag. Oh, good on you, Paul. Thank you so much for that today.
Not a problem.
Good,
have a good one.
Interesting. Good on you. Dr. Paul McDonough there from the University of New England with a question. Are you thinking about what's on your kitchen bench now?